And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. By the way, you could still, to the, I think to the end of this month, you can add on Lanny App, as they say in New Orleans, for CIUT. Just go to donate, and you can still put your shoulder to the wheel. And this kind of programming, I guarantee, as they say in New Orleans, again, there's not a bunch of stations providing interviews with people who have just come back from Syria and who are saying, hands off Syria and no intervention. That Geneva meeting is going to be really something. While we're waiting to speak to our friend here, I just mentioned this is the anniversary of four battles 200 years ago at different ends of the lake at on this date. Well, it's actually tomorrow. No, it's actually today. The U.S. American forces captured Fort George, and the British forces, noticing that they were out of town, tried to capture Sackett's Harbor and were beaten off. That's look it up in your, on your calendar. We're going to be talking shortly, and I believe actually perhaps right now, with Professor Isaac Saini, who was in Toronto, by the way, and was at a forum or a gathering at a different book list where the subject was race and revolution in Cuba. And it was all triggered, I think, or the focus was an article that had been published in the New York Times about the issue of race in Cuba. They seem to do this periodically, usually with not a friendly intent. Are you there, Professor Saini?
Yes, I am.
Hey, it's great to hear you. We're glad you were in town. I'm sorry I missed that talk, but I really want our listeners to know you made a contribution to this. And as a matter of fact, it's a chapter in one of your books on Cuba.
Yep. Yeah, and it was actually when it first came out, a lot of black Cuban scholars on and off the island said it was, at the time, the best treatment in the English language on the issue of race in Cuba.
I bet it hasn't been improved on. Who's written a better one?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of research going on in Cuba. I don't know. I didn't mean it to sort of pat myself on the back, but it was a very profound compliment. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that really led to our this discussion, race and revolution lessons from Cuba, which was a panel discussion in which I sat with Keith Ellis. I mean, mm-hmm. people are familiar with Keith Ellis, one of the professor emeritus at York University.
Yes, and a poet.
A poet, and a scholar in Latin America, and extremely well-respected throughout the field. Mm-hmm. And who continues even in retirement to do a tremendous amount of very important cutting-edge work. We both sat on this panel, and what we were doing was this New York article you spoke about was a very important aspect of the discussion. But more importantly, we were talking about a new collection of essays published by a black Cuban scholar, Afro-Cuban, Esteban Morales, called mm-hmm. Race in Cuba, produced by Monthly Review, in which he does discuss the issue of race within Cuban history, and particularly in the Cuban Revolution, and the existence and racism in Cuba, particularly during the time of the Cuban Revolution, and what this means and so forth. But from the context of arguing that in order to eliminate racism completely in Cuba, what is required is the deepening of the revolutionary project, and socialism in Cuba itself, because it's a very, very, it's a book that doesn't deny the existence of racism in Cuba. It's a very subtle, very nuanced, very insightful analysis mm-hmm. of what's been going on in Cuba, and in fact, in Cuba, a huge debate has broken out in the last 10 years or so, but particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, on the issue of race in Cuba. There are exhibitions, there's government-sponsored activities, and so on. And in fact, there's going to be a new vice president appointed in Cuba whose focus is simply going to be on the issue of race in Cuba and so forth. So there's a huge dynamic and rich debate that's emerged in Cuba. And we were discussing that, as well as talking about how far the revolution has come, and how much, and what it also still needs to do, and so forth, and what are the conditions that have led to this huge debate that has broken out.
Mm-hmm. This is Professor Isaac Saini, I can recall. I hate to admit being this old, but the fact I know that when Cuba was basically a department of the United States, and there was regular trips from basically the American South. They would go, they used to talk about it was only 90 miles away, and they would, white Southerners particularly, would go to Cuba. There were also American gangsters. We know about that. But my understanding was that downtown Cuba, downtown Havana, for example, black people weren't allowed.
Yeah. No, and
because of the sensibilities of North American whites.
Yeah. No, what people need to realize as well is that, you know, they often talk about, and the people who are trying to manipulate race, right, and the existence of racism in Cuba as, you know, a way to discredit the revolution and to justify, U.S. economic sanctions and further U.S. Intervention in Cuba. These are the same people who benefited, right, and who supported the kind of racial segregation that existed in Cuba before that. But I think it's important to give historical perspective, right, or one aspect of this historical perspective, is that, you know, Cuba in the 19th century waged a number of wars, a couple of wars for independence. There was a long, deeply rooted struggle for independence. And on October 10th, 1868, Cuba, which was still a slave society, had a critical event. On October 10th, 1868, Carlos Manuel de Cespedes, who was a plantation owner who had enslaved Africans, called all of his enslaved Africans together. I mean, not that a person can actually be property morally, but these were people who legally, under the law at the time, were his property, and he offered them freedom and then asked them to join him in a struggle for a free and independent Cuba. And so this issue of race became a very important issue. Now, this is what is called the 10 Years' War for the Independence of Cuba, which lasted from 1868 to 1878, ultimately failed, and José Martí, often referred to as the father of the Cuban nation, right? Now, he was born in 1853, so he was a very young man at that time and spent most of his life outside of Cuba. I mean, at 16, he started a newspaper in support of the national liberation movement in Cuba. But when the war failed, you know, he eventually, was exiled from Cuba. But he played a very important intellectual role and organizational role. And one of the things he did was he said that one of the reasons why the struggle failed was through a lack of unity. And one of the issues around that was the question of the lack of racial unity, i.e. the prejudice of white Cubans, particularly the leaders who of the movement, towards actually giving space to black Cubans to participate in the struggle. And eventually, he became very popular among black Cuban communities, and he began to organize on this issue of unity and so forth. And eventually, he formed the Cuban Revolutionary Party, and when the Second War for Independence, what is called the Necessary War, was launched from 1895 to 1898, he was killed very early on. But when that war was launched, it's more than just simply a national liberation struggle. It's a veritable revolution, and there was a fundamental change in many of the social relations during that period of that war. And part of that was the advancement, right, of people of African descent in Cuba into very important positions in society. When the United States intervened in 1898 and snatched victory from the hands of the Cuban liberation fighters, right, the freedom fighters, they reversed all of the gains of black Cubans. And black Cubans, in fact, began to face all sorts of discrimination and segregation, culminating in an attempt to redress this by the formation of the Independent Party of Color, which was against all of the suppression and so forth, resulting in a massacre that took place in 1912, where thousands of black Cubans were killed and so forth. So a whole period of segregation and of a society in which blacks were marginalized and at the bottom of the ladder in terms of all socioeconomic indicators was initiated. And the revolution in 1959, as you point out, played a major role through not only challenging and getting rid of segregation legally, in terms of beaches, nightclubs, and so forth, but also by its massive redistribution of wealth, whether we're talking about land, control of wealth, and so forth, opening up education and other opportunities for everybody, massively benefited black Cubans and so forth. And so this was a watershed moment for black in the history of black Cubans. And what the revolution is doing now and has recognized since 1986 was that they have to intervene more directly economically, culturally, ideologically, and politically in terms of eliminating the vestiges of racism in Cuban society and further elevating blacks. So I often make a theoretical distinction between the fact that Cuba is a society that has racism in it as opposed to Cuba being a racist society, because for me, the critical point is this, is what is the role of the state? Is the state an active generator and promoter and maintainer of a racist social order, so to speak, or is it actively intervening to promote racial inequality and the elevation of people of African descent and other people in that society? And the Cuban state, as Esteban Morales, a black Cuban, points out, and as Pedro Perez Sardui, who is a black Cuban scholar who lives outside of the island, probably the only place in the world where you can say the state is an active ally of people of African descent. Whatever its missteps, whatever its imperfections, whatever its slowness in addressing certain key issues around the issue of race and racism, that ally is the Cuban state.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it brings an echo of discussions that goes on in America, where they have completely dissociated the state from the concept of affirmative action, which was a principal major breakthrough as a result of all the activity of Dr. Martin Luther King and others who lost their lives who in that struggle. And people said, well, this has to be corrected, and the state has a duty to correct it. And that whole epoch has now disappeared. And I don't think the administration of President Obama is interested in affirmative action.
But what you describe is
affirmative action, right?
Yeah, affirmative action in a much more profound and deep way. Maybe a better term is needed, right? Because like in 1986, Fidel Castro at the Third Congress of the Communist Party made a statement that, you know, Cuba had not, because there was a silence around this issue of race, because Cuba as a society from the moment of the Triumphant Revolution faced unrelenting hostility from the United States. It was basically lived in a state of siege, and therefore there was this elevation of the necessity to preserve national unity above all else as the indispensable buttress against being undermined and ultimately destroyed by the United States. But in 1986, Fidel Castro basically said at this third Congress of the Communist Party of Cuba that Cuba racism still existed in Cuba, and Cuba had to deal with this issue. And he began to call for the promotion, among other things, of more blacks into political leadership positions in Cuba. And this has been reemphasized, reaffirmed several times in Cuba, and actually deepened in a fundamental way. But it's also taking place in a way in which social relations and economic relations in the society have been, you know, in many ways fundamentally and radically transformed compared to other capitalists. Societies. So I think that's critically important. When it comes to Obama, and some people have reacted, I mean, Obama can be a very touchy subject. Criticism of Obama can be a very touchy subject to talk about among people who are active in the black movement and so forth. But people universally were very taken aback, shocked, I would say, and extremely perturbed that Michelle Obama, at recent university commencement addresses at historically black colleges, Obama basically waved his finger at black kids and said, you know, stop blaming racism, right? And like, as if racism is not an issue and so forth. So many people were upset at that because he has been demonstrated that he's, you know, in many ways that he's not interested in dealing with the fact that racism is still a fundamental aspect of African American society. While a black elite and a black professional has a class, whichever term we wish to use, has prospered, right? The vast majority of African Americans still labor on what one could consider Jim Crow. Labor under marginalization, labor under incredible rates of incarceration for African American youth, incredible levels of unemployment and education and so forth.
And housing as well.
And in fact, some people make the argument that what's happening is the way the capitalist system has emerged in the 21st century is it's creating, shall we say, whole groups of people who are surplus to capital needs. Now, they're not surplus in the human needs. No human being can ever be surplus, right? But surplus in the needs of the predatory desires, right, and predatory aims of international capital and so forth. So these are very complex phenomena that are unfolding, right? Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I think Cuba offers some lessons, right? It's not a panacea. But it offers some lessons that it's possible, not only for another better world, which is a general phrase, but it's possible to intervene very effectively and very productively and very positively and very progressively in this issue of race and inequality, right? There was an essay that was published in the Globe and Mail kind of 2 or 3 months ago, if I remember correctly. And where the person argued, inequality is natural in society, right? That some people are more better equipped for success than others. Some people are much more naturally talented than others. And therefore, inequality is a sign of a healthy society. So the greater inequality you have, the more healthy society is.
Yes.
And I was just reading an article recently, you know, there's a new person being, I can't remember what position she's going to be appointed to, right? She's been confirmed in the United States, she's going to be in the Obama administration. And she's worth $1.85 billion, right? And so the U.S. Senate, when we talk about, you know, the U.S. Senate being in service of money, I mean, the U.S. Senate actually is composed of people who come from the money.
Yes.
And so there's this very, very profound...
By the way, there's no black American in the United States Senate. They have 100 senators, not one black.
Yeah, and it's this whole plutocracy in which the context of what's happening. Hello?
Oh, yep, gotcha.
The plutocracy of what's happening to African Americans, right, must be looked at and analyzed and so forth. But Cuba offers another alternative, right, and it shows that it's possible to be in this. And mm-hmm. there is a very profound debate emerging in Cuba.
Well, by the way, we could do with some profound debates. When you say that, by the way, now, where would these debates take place? The university? Or the,
well,
what kind of publications would the Cubans find it?
Yeah, they take place, for example, I mean, at the government level, okay, mm-hmm. the highest levels of the government, within the universities, right, in workplaces, in various newspapers. So you can find, for example, in some of the local newspapers and so forth, you can find discussions of this. In Trabajadores, there were articles that were published on this issue, in Granma, and mm-hmm. so forth.
Did they take it up in a journal called Temas.
Yeah. There's a journal mm-hmm. called Temas, mm-hmm. which they've published several articles. And people are now published, and books are being published on this topic, right? And as mm-hmm. I said before, they're taking it very, very seriously at all levels of Cuban society to try mm-hmm. and sort this issue, at least rein it in, right?
Yeah. Now, by the way, they're culturally a very powerful country. They make films and theater and such and music. Is it taken up in the realm of culture?
Well, it's slowly. In one way they've been taking up is basically there's some soap operas that have addressed this issue, and as well as some people are probably familiar with the hip hop movement in Cuba, which is much is not less misogynistic and less less violent than other forms of it that have emerged, unfortunately, in North America. But they've taken up this issue a mm-hmm. lot in the music and cultural forms as well as in art fiction that's written as well. Mm-hmm. So there's this explosion, right, of discussion and debate both on the academic level, the official level, as I said, in sites like universities, in sites like music performances and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I think this thing is only going to grow and only going to expand because it's a very important issue Cuba must tackle.
If you say soap opera, I figure we're really getting to it.
Well, operas. Cubans love their telenovelas.
I don't know why, but it seems every culture has got it. And if you're not talking about it there, you may as well not be talking. This is Isaac Saney, by the way, a professor. He's at Dalhousie. I want to make sure people know it. It's CIUT, Taylor Report.
Philip, I may be allowed to give a plug for a symposium that's been organized on September 27th and 28th, we're going to be holding a symposium called at the University of Toronto at William Dew Auditorium, which is at 45 Wilcox Street. We're holding a symposium called Africa's Unknown War, Apartheid, Terror, Cuban, Southern African Liberation. So we're going to look at Cuba's decisive contribution it made to ending racist rule in South Africa. We have people coming up from the States, scholars like Pedro Vejeces. We have people coming from Cuba. We'll have people coming from South Africa. It's going to be a big event and so forth. I'm the chair of the organizing committee, but we have other people involved. It's co-sponsored by the Caribbean Studies Program of the University of Toronto. A different book list is involved. The James mm-hmm. Robinson Chair of Black Canadian Studies at Dalhousie University is involved. And so this is something that's going to be held on September 27th and 28th. And it's going to be a very important event. And you yourself are involved as well.
Well, that's great.
By
the way, you talk definitely they have impact. And of course, you had a film, and there's a book about the Cubans fighting the South Africans in Angola. Yeah. But also in South America, I was thinking, it seems to be part of the socialist struggle that they have. This issue has to be in the forefront because I think of Hugo Chavez and people. The right wing attacked him because he was proud of his African descent, and it seems to be an issue throughout South America as well. They must be watching Cuba closely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you raise a very important point. This issue of race running right through Latin American history, right, is mm-hmm. critical at this particular point in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, Hugo Chavez, being a person of mixed heritage was one, and this in itself. I mean, I taught a course on Latin American history, right, mm-hmm. at Dalhousie University this year. We both colonial Latin American history in Latin America after independence. And one of the things that emerged in this whole discussion, right, as I pointed out, was that not only did we have these racially stratified society, what in many cases were pigmentocracies that emerged, mm-hmm. but the
pigmentocracy. I like that.
Yeah, but what also emerged was the fact that the people, who were the rulers of the society, that small elite strata, right, they mm-hmm. themselves, considered it their divine right to rule, right, that this, they were the ones who were ordained to rule. And in fact, that citizenship was something that only belonged to them. So, for example, you know, when people like Evo Morales is elected, okay, who's an indigenous person, right, in Bolivia, when a mixed race person in many ways, such as Chavez, is elected, right, when you have people like this who are electing, it's not only a transformation of power relations, but it's also fundamentally unacceptable, unacceptable psychologically, right, to the this, you know, ruling elite. Okay,
yes.
And in fact, I mean, if anybody, I don't know if your listeners have ever seen a very good movie on Oscar Romero, who was the El Salvadorian bishop. I considered Raul Julia's greatest role. People probably remember Raul Julia was playing Gomez in the Addams Family, but he played the lead role of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who moved from being somebody who was apolitical, right, to somebody who became a voice in El Salvador against the bloody military dictatorship. And in that film is a very poignant moment. One of the members, the wife of one of the members of the ruling elite, overwhelmingly white, okay, she has a child that's born, and she wants this child to be christened, and she comes to Archbishop Romero and asks him to do it, and he says, yes, I do christenings, right, you know, on Wednesdays, for example, right, but he does mass christenings, and she looks around, and she sees it's basically, you know, that, you know, he wants her to be christened along with all these other Indian children. She says, you want me to be christened with these people? She says, with disgust, right? So when Chavez was elected, when Morales was elected, when people who are from the traditionally despised classes, right, okay, are elected, right, what happens is it's a fundamentally unacceptable, right?
Yes.
It's not just politically, it's just so fundamentally unacceptable to the very fiber of their being.
Absolutely.
That this elite just goes absolutely crazy. So,
yes.
For example, Chavez was often portrayed as a monkey. And in fact, at the U.S. Embassy, and he had to apologize to this was years ago, Hugo Chavez was portrayed as a monkey. I mean, so you can imagine the visceral hatred they have for the people who are supposed to be the servants, the people who are supposed to do the menial tasks, to clean the lavatories, right? To do all of these activities. Suddenly they're empowering themselves. Suddenly they say they can rule.
Yeah.
Suddenly they actually think they can participate.
The world is coming to an end.
The world is coming to an end. I mean, it reminds me of the Haitian Revolution, for example. I mean, you can actually, just on the eve of the Haitian Revolution, where, you know, the Africans of Haiti rose up, right, and overthrew that order and, you know, initiated concepts such as self-determination and so forth. But before that, you can actually read personal letters, read diaries, right, from, for example, you know, there's one case where, you know, a plantation owner is writing to his wife, right? And, you know, and this is after these people, you know, some of them have been influenced, you know, some of these plantation owners are taking sides in the French Revolution. They're discussing these ideas openly, you know, as they're having tea while they're enslaved Africans, right? Walking around serving them and so forth. He writes a letter saying, man, these people are incapable of thinking of freedom, incapable of organizing, right? They're happy, right? And of course, the Haitian Revolution explodes. It's a fundamentally racist and Eurocentric conception who can think and who cannot think, who can rule and who cannot rule, right?
Exactly.
Who are meant to be the people who are supposed to be the architects, okay, and the drivers of the world, as opposed to those who are supposed to be the beasts of burden. And so this kind of racialized, this fundamentally perverted way of thinking, right, you know, I think is part and parcel of the reaction of these Latin American elites to people who were supposed to be despised and downtrodden, suddenly asserting their right, because they're the vast majority of the society, to control that society, to participate in decision makers, and take hold of their destiny.
Yes, and as you say, it's a cycle. It becomes a source of a lot of the pathological behavior, because you're dealing with people who cannot swallow the idea that of humanity. They can only think of their own class and their own group.
Yeah,
and
I
after
mean,
that, it's the abyss.
It's the abyss.
And they do go crazy. What you describe sounds like all the diaries I've read of slave owners.
Yeah,
and they're always kidding themselves. Either the slave is happy as it can be, or he's totally lazy. Or he's, you know, but he cannot see a human being.
Yeah.
It's always has to be made into some sort of subspecies. This is Isaac Saini. I want to make sure I ask you this. You are a frequent traveler to Cuba yourself. What have you observed your own over the years in terms of seeing relations between Afro-Cubans and others? How is that? What have you
seen? I see Cuba as being a fundamentally, probably the least racist society I've ever been in, right? That's one point. But I think it's also important to understand that one of the things that really has fascinated me was that, you know, when the revolution triumphed in 1959, you know, Cuba was coming out of having been a colonial possession of Spain and then being a neo-colonial possession of the United States. And you had fundamental levels of racism and inequality. And then from 1959 to 1989, you had very significant advances made, right? And so forth. Yes, while inequality between, or the bridge, the gap between blacks and whites was closing very significantly and in many cases very quickly, you still had a gap, right? And this gap was due to the fact that, you know, one, you know, the Cuban process from 1959 to 1989, I'll say why I've chosen that 30-year period first to talk about, was that, one, you know, they were still in the process of transforming the society, and 30 years is a very short time in which to erase, yes, the vestiges of colonial and capitalist domination. But also, they also realized that they had, you know, adopted a very dogmatic conception, right? Like, the issue was that racism would disappear once you began to deal with class and material conditions, and they realized that, no, you have to intervene directly in that. Yeah. And then what happened was, when the Soviet Union Eastern Bloc collapsed, Cuba had to go back on a road, walk back on a piece of road that they thought they'd never walk back on again. And so there were a number of things, we can call it concessions to the market, concessions to capitalism, things like tourism, foreign investment, self-employment activity that they had to introduce. And one of the things, obviously, was the decriminalization of hard currency. And what happened was that the decriminalization of holding hard currency led to the fact that those who had access to hard currency, okay, and, you know, this, now if you go to Cuba now, you know, you have the CUC, the convertible peso, that acts as a proxy for hard currency. But those who had access to hard currency, you know, could now have a better standard of living. And what had happened was, when the revolution triumphed at the beginning of the 60s, you know, you had all these rich and professionals and so forth who fled because they were opposed to these measures about, yes, that were about equity and equality and so forth, and they were overwhelmingly white. And then, mm-hmm, when all this money began to come back into Cuba, okay, people sending remittances, and anybody who lives in the so-called South, lived in Latin America, know that remittances are very important parts of economies. People sending money back home to their relatives and family and so forth and so on. That this money was coming back from whites to overwhelmingly whites in Cuba, and so this began to introduce some, mm-hmm, inequalities. So one of the points I talked about was that I think Cuba is also a laboratory where you can, you know, in a sense, where you can look at the relationship of what forms of economic organizations reduce racism and what forms of economic organizations or dynamics lead to the racism and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. Not only in terms of socioeconomic and so forth, but also in terms of ideational and ideological aspects of it, right? But also what happened was, I saw that the state didn't stand idly by. The Cuban state began to intervene directly in many cases, right? And my book talks about that, and Esteban Morales, in his new book that recently came out, talks about that in some detail and so forth. So what I see in Cuba is a society that's an analytic project, we can look at, if I may use that term, laboratory, right, to look at the relationship of capitalism to racism and the relationship of socialist means, mm-hmm, of organizing society to reducing racism, the active role of a state can play in actually eliminating that, but also that despite all of these things, despite the fact that inequality has emerged in Cuba that is large by Cuban standards, by the rest of Latin America and the rest of the so-called South America, even by comparison to the rest of the world, it's small in comparison to what exists in these places I've just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. So it shows that it's possible that human beings are not these atomized, you know, as Margaret Thatcher believed. She said, there's no society, there's just individuals. We're not these atomized, selfish, rational actors who are just interested in what we can get as opposed to social solidarity and social love, right? And yes, collectivity, that we are different people. We can build a society that, you know, is truly human and is not simply some sort of fantasy. It's possible, right? So that's what I've seen in Cuba. And I've also seen that, you know, that when you have a state that's truly a product of a revolutionary movement of the people, that state has the capacity to say, we made missteps, we made omissions here, we even made commissions here, and we are willing to alter that, and we are willing to intervene to promote equity and equality, and so forth. So I see that, and, you know, Cuba, you know, when you think about it, and people were comparing, I mean, Cuba is a place where, you know, a black child to aspire to be a doctor, a lawyer, right? A scientist. It's not a big thing because they have access, free access to education, and they're not denied that opportunity. Yeah. I mean, it's a big thing in North America.
That's aspire to. They've got it. Dr. Saini, thank you very, very much. We look forward to seeing you September 27, 28 at the University of Toronto.
Well, thank you very much, Phil. I've always enjoyed chatting with you, and I find your program to be an exceptionally valuable and a very important instrument in our struggle for a better world.
Oh, thank you. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. And that's Dr. Isaac Saini. This is the Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and we'll see you next week.